Hi, I'm Kathy Forstie, music director at Casey Cafe Radio. We're very happy to have Emmy Award-winning writer, comedian, actress, singer-songwriter Tracy Newman as an artist on Casey Cafe Radio. Tracy is a founding member of the famous Groundlings comedy troupe, and she's also an Emmy and Peabody Award-winning writer of Ellen, and the creator and writer of several network comedies over the years. Tracy is also, of course, an amazing singer-songwriter. Her newest album is That's What Love Can Do to Your Heart, and it's her third album. Thanks so much, Tracy, for taking the time to talk with me today on Casey Cafe Radio.
Thank you. Hi, Kathy.
Good to talk to you again. We saw each other, what, about 2 years ago?
Was it at the official showcase?
At Far West,
is that
yeah.
what it was?
Uh-huh.
At Far West, and I think I was emceeing or some
yes.
kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was an interesting job.
It's fun, though. We're going back to
Far
West
this
year.
Oh, yeah, I always have fun there. In fact, I advise everybody who's a singer-songwriter to apply. Well, first of all, to go to those things,
mm-hmm.
those conferences are really fun because you just meet everybody that's doing the same thing you are, but also to apply for the showcase. I'm a judge this year, so, you know, that's going to be kind of different
yeah.
for me.
I'm going to be a judge as well, so.
Oh, good.
I wanted to ask you a little bit. You've had such a variety in your career. You've done everything. So I was just wondering, when you fill out a loan application, what do you put down for occupation?
Well, if I did that, I haven't actually by myself or, you know, sat down and I think I did with my husband many, many years ago when we first bought a house, filled out one of those. But these days I would probably put, I'd put TV writer just because that then I would probably get the loan. Because if I put singer-songwriter, they would probably laugh at me.
I'd say they don't make any money. We can't have that.
No, we don't make any money. But I did. I have to say, I quit TV to be a singer-songwriter. So I went from a paying job to a non-paying job.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's. I mean, you're doing what you love, so that's what's important, right there.
Yeah, you know, I was a singer-songwriter before I wrote for television, and while I was writing, I wrote for television for 20 years. And you know, I think when we're young, we think that when we get older, that our life is over. And so we won't want to do anything. But suddenly I realized here, I've been writing for television for 20 years. I'd like to be a singer-songwriter again. Am I too old for that? I don't know, but I'm not going to get any younger, so I better quit now.
Yeah.
So I quit television to go back to doing really what I originally loved.
So would you consider music your first love then?
Well, playing the guitar was, you know, I know that doesn't mean I'm a great guitar player, but I've been playing since I was 14 and it's very natural to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, depending on my mood or whatever, I can always just, if I see my guitar, I'll just pick it up. It's just a natural thing and put the strap on and walk around,
mm-hmm.
you know, and doing nothing, just noodling.
Yeah. So at 14, what was the music you were listening to and what were you playing on your guitar?
You're basically asking me how old I am. When I started out, among other things, the Kingston Trio were popular. And the Kingston Trio played the easiest songs possible. I mean, they played, for one thing, they had a huge hit with a song called Tom Dooley,
mm-hmm.
which is two chords. And so I quickly mastered that. And, you know, I just learned to play all of their songs and all of the folk singers that were popular back then. Everything they were playing was accessible to me. So I was considered a guitar player right away. I mean, I was actually teaching children how to play the guitar and their parents when I was a teenager because I was considered a guitar player. But I was really just strumming and changing chords.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and
kids do so quickly now.
Yeah, I'm a teacher myself, and that's what I kind of do with the job that actually pays me money is teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, some kids pick up on it quickly, and others don't. Yeah, you know, some kids don't really get.
Yeah,
that
I don't know
goal.
What it's like now, but back then, you know, it was they didn't pick up on it that quickly back then. You know, at least the students that I had didn't right away. They didn't have YouTube, they didn't have,
mm-hmm.
you know, all of the ways that you can see what somebody's doing. You can watch their hands.
Right.
They didn't have that. So it was, you know, their parents would choose to have them do it. It wasn't the kids saying, I want to do that.
Right.
So it was a kind of a different vibe back then. And I would get like $10 an hour to teach. And, you know, I've seen in the over the years some of those people actually went on to be singer-songwriters, which was very gratifying.
Yeah, that's great. So you said it that we were talking about this earlier. In the Wikipedia page, it talks about that you were a member of the New Christy Minstrels. Can you talk about that a little bit? How did you get that gig?
Well, I was singing with Barry McGuire, who you might know, you know, did the song The Eve of Destruction. He had a big hit with that and several other songs. And he was like a pipe fitter, a plumber back then. And I met him and we started dating. And he was playing a little bit of guitar and I was kind of a better guitar player. So we started to work together and I started teaching him stuff. And there was a duo that was popular back then called Art and Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Not Simon and Garfunkel Art and Paul, but another Art and Paul.
Yeah,
and that's
Art
an
Podell.
Interesting story. Yeah, Art Podell.
Yeah.
So that whole thing is such an interesting story because mm-hmm. they were both acts, you know, Art and Paul and Simon and Garfunkel were signed to Columbia Records at the time, but Simon and Garfunkel wanted to call themselves Art and Paul, but Columbia already had an Art and Paul. So they had to call themselves Simon and Garfunkel. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but that's not about me. So, I was playing at a club in Westwood. It was not a real club. It was like a Mexican restaurant called the El Toril, or I should say El Toril, since El means the. And Barry McGuire and I were a duo. And we were sort of discovered there by, and you know, I don't know why, I can't remember if it was the managers of the Christies at the time or if it was Randy himself, Randy Sparks, who created the group. But anyway, we were brought on to the Christies, but I was brought on as a replacement for a woman who had just quit and they were about to do some TV shows, so they needed to replace her quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So the Christies is 10 people. It's 8 men and 2 women.
Mm-hmm.
And so I joined, and I was blonde, and so was the other girl. And my range was alto, and so was hers. So, you know, when it came time to really step up with that group, and they had to go on, they were hired by the Andy Williams Show. I don't even know if you know who
mm-hmm.
that is.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. I live near
but
Branson.
I don't know if your listeners know. But they were hired as backup singers on there, and I just didn't have the range. They needed a brunette. They dropped a number of us when the Andy Williams Show hired the group. Some of them had to read music. I didn't read music. So I was in there for about 2 months, and oh my God, it was one of the most exciting things, certainly the most exciting thing I had done by then, you know, at that time in my life.
Yeah.
I was a teenager, you know.
Which
was
young.
Another problem. I had to get permission to do everything from my parents.
Mm-hmm.
So they just, you know, and they were all older than me.
Yeah.
So that was not it was not a good fit, but I was loving it. I loved it because I loved their show.
Yeah.
I loved being plugged into it.
Yeah, just.
And, you know, I had the skills to do it. I mean, I could play guitar and sing. That's all you needed.
Yeah. It's just like you didn't fit the suit or whatever, like they did.
No, I was not, you know, I just was too young.
Yeah.
I didn't understand what was going on.
Yeah, but you did do some television stuff when you were young, though, right?
Yeah, I did. Well, I was like 23 or 24 when I did a series in New York called What's New. It was an ongoing series. It was like they plugged me into this series and I got to do my own shows. I did 6 episodes of this thing called What's New, and mine was folk music from around the world. So I wrote these half-hour shows, and they shot me doing these half-hour shows, and they're on YouTube now. And I'm telling you, I'm getting more attention for that as a singer-songwriter, as a mm-hmm. folk singer, than I ever got for anything else on YouTube. It's so funny to watch that, you know, to see. It's because I'm putting these black and white videos up of me playing banjo. I'm not even a banjo player. I learned to play one song.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's on there. So I did 6 episodes. I did 10 songs in each episode. So I have 60 of these tapes.
Wow.
And so it's interesting. I get I have my own YouTube channel like a lot of people do. And most of it is just that stuff from 1965.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of new fans who probably think I just made those shows.
Well, everything vintage comes back around again, so.
Yeah, it really does. You should look it up. It's called, just look up Tracy Newman, What's New. And the song that I like the best is me doing Cripple Creek on the banjo. And it's like, you know, I'm actually look like I can really play. It's really fun.
That's great. I will look that up. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Was your family a show business family?
No. Well, you know, I was raised by my mother and my stepfather. Really, my real father, they got divorced. My mom and dad, my real father got divorced when I was five. But he was an actor. So, yes, in that respect, you know. But he was also not much of a working actor. You know, back it was like around the time of after the Depression, and he was a shoe salesman. But he had studied to be an actor, and he was in movies and stuff. So, I mean, I can actually see him in movies from back then.
Mm-hmm. So is he was he like a part actor? Was he like a...
No, just one line, two lines. But okay. I know that the actor John Garfield liked him and used him a lot as an extra and as a one- or two-line player.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'll see something like Destination Tokyo is on, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing on the TCM channel, and I'll mm-hmm. tape it, and I have this footage of my real father in the background there, you know, or saying one line. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, neat.
You know, he was very young, so he was like, my parents had me when they were 20, or uh-huh. she was 20. I think he was a little bit older.
So is anybody else in your family musical? I know your sister, Lorraine, is,
well,
of course,
Lorraine
a comedy.
Well, you know, from SNL, but Paul, my brother Paul, Lorraine has a twin. His name is Paul Newman, but he calls himself Dutch Newman. He changed his name a long time ago because of, you know, obvious reasons.
Uh-huh.
He's getting fan calls for Paul Newman all the time.
Uh-huh.
And so he has a group called Dutch Newman and the Musical Melodians, or the Melodians or something like that. I'm acting like I've never seen them. I've seen them a million times. Uh-huh. But I think he changes his name now and then, so... But it's Dutch Newman, and that's worth looking up. He does, like, songs from the 20s, and it's just, it's uncanny. And he didn't start doing anything until he was in his late 40s.
Oh,
he played the guitar, but he didn't mm-hmm. start performing until my stepfather and his real father, until he died.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was afraid to get up and perform while my father was alive.
So why do you think that was?
My stepfather was a businessman,
mm-hmm.
and other than the fact that, you know, when Lorraine started doing SNL, they were very proud of her, but they really didn't want their kids to be in show business.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I was in the Groundlings, and I was a singer-songwriter, and they were always trying to get me to go back to school.
Mm-hmm.
And... you know, I even went to Lawton School for Dental Assistants to become a dental assistant and worked for a while as a dental assistant. I mean, they were always trying to get me to find something to fall back on, you know. And that was the thing that you did back then when your kids went into show business. So they didn't get anywhere with Lorraine and Paul, though. Lorraine and Paul just, she went into show business. And he was in business with his dad for a long time, with my stepfather. And then...
Mm-hmm.
As soon as our father died, he quit business and started playing the guitar and got a band and has been performing now for ever since my father died, which might be, I can't remember the year right this moment, but it's about 10 years.
Yeah.
Or eight years he's been doing it.
Well, that's great. So everybody went into show business eventually then.
Yeah, and I have an older brother who was the lighting designer at the Roxy on Sunset,
mm-hmm.
and he was traveling with Van Halen and doing their lighting and stuff, so he was kind of in show business too. He quit, you know, many years ago, but
mm-hmm.
that was where he went too.
At what point did you go from playing your guitar on these television shows to doing comedy?
Well, when I lived in New York, which was only 2 years, like 1965 and 19, like the end of 64 to the middle of 66, around there, it's like 2 years in there, I used to do my shows like at the Bitter End or wherever I was playing, and then I would go to the Improv, which was on 44th and 9th. That was before all the other Improvs popped up, which was in the 80s, I guess. Or no, there was a... 70s, late 70s? When, I don't remember when comedy started to have a big boom.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I used to hang around the Improv in New York, and it was like everybody was there. You know, it was Lily Tomlin, Richard Pryor, Rodney Dangerfield, Liza Minnelli and Bette Midler used to hang out there. They were already stars, but they would drop in. And many of these people, they weren't stars yet, you know. David Letterman, Jay Leno, literally, you know, the future of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
They were all there. And I was a singer-songwriter, and I would get up and sing and play the guitar. I was one of the few people that did that. And they'd sort of indulge me, you know, because I was young and cute. And that's probably why. You know, you think the action began after midnight there, and I'd be up till 4 in the morning singing and playing and hanging out with these comics and watching improv. I had never seen improv, and these guys would get up and just, you know, improvise. Robert Klein would improvise songs, and Lily Tomlin was improvising, and I just was like, and I did off-Broadway plays with some of these people for a short while. You know, I kind of, it like whet my appetite for that. And then when I came back, I actually was a nursery school teacher for a while and playing in clubs, little coffee houses. And then in the 70s, I just happened to go to this improv class that was being taught by Gary Austin, who is credited with starting the Groundlings. And he did start the Groundlings, I mean, but he's, you know, there were other people too, but he was the main guy. And, you know, I just really gravitated towards the work they were doing and brought my sister there. And then we started doing shows because we all thought we were really funny. And then Lily Tomlin and Lauren Michaels came to the show, and Lauren was looking to start a show, and Lily Tomlin was doing a special that Lauren was producing, and so they plucked a couple of Groundlings out of the show, Lorraine being one of them, and then eventually she was offered SNL. By the way, several other Groundlings were offered SNL, and they turned it down. Because if you think about it, back then, we're talking about 1974-ish, 74. Some of these people in the class that became the Groundlings were working in show business already. They were very successful in commercials. They were doing TV, and they had a career going.
Right.
And so they would have to leave L.A. and moved to New York to do SNL, and, you know, SNL wasn't what it became. It was just he was trying to get a show on the air.
Right.
So Lorraine took the chance of leaving L.A. and joining this group of people, which turned out to be this iconic show. Mm-hmm. But nobody knew that was going to happen, of course.
Right. Yeah. Well, that was her good fortune, you know.
Yes, she also talented, you know. I mean, she had the right skills in the right place at the right time. She did great characters.
Yeah.
I mean, you only have to go back and look at those shows to see how great Lorraine was.
Mm-hmm.
And is still. She does. Now she's doing cartoon voices and stuff and still acts on camera sometimes, but mostly is doing, you know, she has kids now, so she's like started doing cartoons.
Right.
That's what a lot of people who have those skills, if they have kids, they start doing cartoons.
Yeah, so when you were in the Groundlings, were you doing characters too, or were you doing improv stuff?
I was doing a lot of stuff. I was teaching because I had, of course, I was qualified because I had seen improv being done at the Improv in New York. I had no qualification to teach, other than that I was very entertained by all of this. And so I would set up situations that entertained me, and that was my... That's my contribution as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And then learn to write, really, there. That's where I really learned not just to write comedy, but to write songs. My skill was and still is and always has been being myself on stage. I'm very comfortable on stage, and I'm just myself. And so I did a lot of acting scenes, you know, where I was pretty much, if not myself, with my own name. I was somebody that was just like me with a different name.
Mm-hmm.
So that I didn't have to act and I didn't have to do characters. It was not my skill.
So at what point did you go from doing the Groundlings to writing for television? How did that manifest?
Well, you know, when we were in the Groundlings, I was in there for 15 years.
Wow.
From like 1972.
So you know just about everybody that's been through the door there.
Well, you know, up to a certain point, I'd say that the cutoff is when Will Ferrell was there. I mean, I know Melissa McCarthy a little bit and Kristen Wiig. These are people I could say hello to, and they might know my name or remember me. But, you know, I left when Will Ferrell was pretty much, might have been there already, or he was just coming in. And but you know, my time was when Lorraine was there and when Phil Hartman was there and John Lovitz and, you know, the earlier stars of SNL.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Groundlings became like a farm company for SNL. That's what it is now.
Yeah.
But we were just starting a group that, you know, that germinated out of a class, which is the way things start, you know. And so I learned how to write by rewriting sketches. And then one of the other Groundlings, so because it was the future of comedy was what was there. Just like the future of comedy was at the Improv in New York in 1965. You know, anybody who was funny, who wanted to be in show business, if they had the goods, it was an easier time to break in. Although it's easy now in other ways. I mean, easy isn't probably not the right word, but you have a lot of opportunities now because of the internet. I'd say that I learned all those skills at the Groundlings, and then one of the other Groundlings, John Stark, who is a friend of mine from there, asked me if I wanted to write a spec script with him. I had just had a child, too. And I thought, well, you know, maybe writing for television is a good way to make a living. And, you know, I was married, and he was an actor. And there were times, though, when he didn't work, and I thought, I'm going to have to do something, and here I have this kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I started writing spec scripts with my friend John Stark, and then we got hired. Our first show was Cheers. And, you know, so we started, in a way, we started kind of at the top. We just kept going from there. We worked literally from then on. Mm-hmm. Our entire career. We worked, went from show to show, or we stayed, like on Ellen, we stayed there for four seasons, five seasons, however long that lasted. We didn't stay for the, after the coming out episode. She cleaned house and had a whole new staff for the very last season. But we were there for from the beginning until after the coming out episode. So anyway, he asked me to, you know, if I wanted to write a spec script, and that's how we started, you know, and we both knew the people running Cheers at the time because they were Groundlings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, if you come to L.A. and you want to be in show business and you're funny, go to the Groundlings and join the school. You'll be in the next group. That's the future of comedy in television in L.A.
I want to ask you about the Ellen episode, the coming out episode. I remember, wasn't the original title of that show, like, These Friends of Mine or something like that?
Yes, you've done your homework.
Yeah, no, actually, I just remember it because I used to love that show.
Yeah, it was These Friends of Mine for about four episodes.
Okay.
And trying to remember if Friends had started. Because if Friends had already started, then that's why they used that title.
Mm-hmm.
And if Friends had not started but was just starting, or, you know, then I'd say that they got rid of that title because of Friends. But, you know, truthfully, it was foolish to call it anything but Ellen, you know, because she was so clearly the show.
Right, yeah, she was the star. So was there, like, a conversation with Ellen about writing that episode, the coming out episode?
Well, you know, first of all, we had done three or four seasons before that. A lot of the episodes were her dating guys.
Right.
And she just announced at the end of the, I don't know what season it was, season three maybe or season four, I don't want to date guys anymore. And was like, what do we do? She's like runs a bookstore and has these friends. And then, you know, I don't even, you know, it's like, there's just so many shows where she can get her foot caught in a bucket, you know.
Right.
And then she had a party, and then she announced at that party that she wanted to come out next season on the show. She wanted to gear the whole season toward her coming out in real life and on the show. And so I remember my partner, who's a man, you know, he's like 10 years younger than me, and he had children by then and, you know, married, and he was very worried. And not that we weren't all in our own ways worried, but it never struck me for one minute that this wouldn't be the best place for us. But he was nervous about it. I mean, I've heard him talk about it, too, on interviews, how he wanted to get out of there. You know, not that he didn't agree with it. He did agree with the whole thing. He just, he felt like we would be under a microscope, and he didn't want all that attention. Me, on the other hand, I wanted all that attention. No, I just thought it was, I felt like I'm going to be so proud to be here, you know.
Yeah.
It felt like the thing to be, the most important thing that was happening in television at the time in my mind.
It was groundbreaking.
And
really
she was like the perfect person to do it, because everybody loved her. So I, you know, I talked him into staying, and he was glad he did, but it was a very tough year.
Mm-hmm.
you know, we had bomb scares. We had people, because everybody, all the information leaked ahead of time. And, you know, with that many people working on something, it was bound to leak.
Right.
It was, you know, people threatening Disney, you know, with boycotts, fundamentalists or Christian right. I mean, just, it was.
Yes, I remember that.
It was a very scary, you know, and they kept those emails and those letters from Ellen. She didn't see all the hate mail.
Yeah.
But it was gross. And, you know, so, yeah, it was an intense time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it was an important time, and it was a groundbreaking mm-hmm. time. And it was, you know, I'm so glad that you did that, and you were, it's great that you were a part of that as well, so...
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
And we, you know, when we went to the Emmys, you know, we were nominated, my partner and I, and because we were chosen to write the first half hour of that, which ends with her announcing over the PA at the airport that she's gay.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we, so that episode was up for an Emmy. And, you know, we were sitting in the audience there and watched. The director thing, I think, happened before us, and he didn't win, the director of that episode, which might have been after we won. Anyway, whatever was going on there, we were thinking, oh, this does not look good. And we were up against a great episode of Seinfeld, and it just was, you know, we just never occurred to us, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Really never occurred to us that we would really win this. And, you know, I'm sitting in the audience with my shoes off because they were killing me. And they were hard to get on, you know, high heels. Mm-hmm. And when they announced our names, it was like, I don't even remember what happened after that. I know I put my shoes on.
Uh-huh.
I had to run up the aisle in these shoes that were like, so painful. But I don't remember anything. I mean, I just sailed up there. I was so happy.
Mm-hmm.
So was she. We were just, it was like unbelievable.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then our careers, from then on, we were looked at as people who could run a show and all sorts of things that took us way beyond what we were capable of or what
right.
we felt capable. And, then, you know, that's how you learn, though.
Right, yeah. It's if you can stand up to the task that's given before you, I mean, yeah, you gotta go for it. I want to ask you about the Nell Scovell book, just the funny parts.
I so wish I had written that. I mean, read that. I wish I'd written it too, probably. No, I wish I had read it. I've been planning on buying it and haven't bought it yet.
Yeah, it's a very good book, and I mean,
I know
there's a lot
her,
of
so, yeah.
there's a lot of inside stories about, you know, Hollywood and stuff, and so that's kind of fun too. But you know, the big theme of the book is the Hollywood Boys Club, but in writers' rooms. Where there's mm-hmm. usually 10 male writers and one female writer. Did you run up against that in your career?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I don't think I had it as bad. First of all, I was older. I don't usually like to divulge my age, but my first television writing job was Cheers in the 10th season of Cheers, 1991. I was 46, something like that. I'm not sure if I was 45, 47, 46, around there. And so I not only did I fill their female quota, but I filled their age quota because they had quotas for all this stuff.
Yeah.
And my partner was a man 10 years younger than me. So they were getting two for the price of one, and they were filling their quota with me. And there was another woman there. The room was, this is Cheers I'm talking about in the 10th season. The room was run by boys from like Harvard or Princeton or wherever they were from, you know, from the Lampoon guys, and they were in their 20s. So they really did not like having me in the room because I was their mother's age. So talk about having to prove yourself, and I certainly did not prove myself in any way at Cheers. We were there for a year, and then we left to do one of Bob Newhart's shows with the executive producers who weren't in the room at Cheers. You know, they were busy creating a new Bob Newhart show. But we were there for a year, and I learned how a show was run by looking at the 10th season of Cheers, which is a great way to learn how to run a show because that was really a tight ship. You came in at 10 o'clock, and you left at 6 like a normal person. And I thought that's the way all the shows were run. And then we went through years of being on shows that were so poorly run that we would be going home at 4 a.m. or at midnight. And it was just was very difficult to have a child and be in that situation. So, you know, some of the rooms, like that room was very tough for me. Some of the boys, those boys, and I'm going to call them boys because they really were very dismissive of me and very rough on women. We went to Bob for a while, and that was okay because we were that was run by our friends. But then we went to the Nanny for a year, and there were women in the room, in fact, quite a few women, but that was a rough room as well for various other reasons. And then we started to go into rooms of just essentially men. Mm-hmm. And it was tough for me, but I never felt, I was not harassed. I'm sure it's because I was older. Even though I was still, you know, like a cute little blonde, they left me alone. Mm-hmm. But I did see things, you know, I saw a lot of things, not with the women in the room, but women, you know, who worked there, who had to put up with a lot of harassment. And, you know, I just was another one of those women who didn't speak up, you mm-hmm. know, watched a lot of things, not just harassment, but racism and stuff against Jews. I'm Jewish, so I would see that, and I would wonder if this is a time to speak up, or is this a time to keep my mouth shut? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I never really spoke up about any of those things I saw.
Yeah. Well, it's...
But we would talk about it in the room. You know, we'd talk about certain things. The people who weren't involved, we would talk about it. And usually the reason we wouldn't speak up would be, you know, hey, we're trying to get a show on the air. Well, let's not make waves right now. This isn't the time to do that. Let's pick our battles. You know, it was all those excuses.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't, I can't have to say, I never saw anything that was so egregious that I'd had to speak up. I
yeah.
never really saw that,
mm-hmm.
you know. But, no, it's the writer's room, because the guys are usually so funny, and the women, too, that end up there, is really fun for about 4 hours. But when you're
yeah.
there for 10 hours and then you don't know when you're going home, it's that job that you know, you've been praying for and working so hard to get and so glad that you're there, and then you can't wait to go home, you know?
Yeah.
So, it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, yeah, I understand. I worked in, you know, news and television for a while too much, and you know,
oh my God,
the first you know, couple hours you're like, oh, this is good, and then you're there for the fifth hour and you're like, oh, I'm ready to go home now. Yeah, so there's only so much of it you can take.
It finally got to the point where when we created According to Jim, finally we were the bosses, and I have to say that. I'd go have lunch and then go into my office after that and fall asleep on the couch until my partner would knock on the door and say, are you coming to work? Are you going to join us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I took advantage of being a boss like anybody does.
Yeah.
You know, when you don't really have to be in the room, why go there?
Right, yeah.
You know, when you've hired people who can handle it without you, why go there?
Yes, and a lot of times that's the best way for creativity to happen. It's, you know, stay out of their way and let them create, so.
That's right.
So let's get to your music. At what point did you decide to get out of writing for television and such and do your own thing with music?
Well, I quit, According to Jim, as soon as it went into syndication, which was the end of the second season, I think it was. Around 2003, I think, I quit, and I immediately went to Nashville and took one of those, you know, songwriting 101 weekends,
mm-hmm.
and I just plunged right into it. I signed up for Harriet Schock's songwriting class. I just wanted to immerse myself in songwriting and be around songwriters, everybody who was trying to do the same thing. Because even though I had written songs over the years, and had written a lot of songs for TV when I was there, as well as writing scripts, I had learned how to economize writing half-hour shows. I really understood now how to tell the story in a short amount of time. So I thought, now I can write a story in 3 or 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I got to get really, really good at. and that was what I worked on. And one of the first things I wrote was Waffle Boy. I don't know if you know that song, but it's like a 5-minute song. It's a story. It was something that I actually saw that weekend, that very first weekend in Nashville. I went to a Waffle House. I sat down at the counter, and I watched this whole story unfold in front of me. And I embellished it and made a song out of it. It became the template for my story songs. Mm-hmm. Of the way you get to a story song is hopefully you actually see it happen. Or something, a germ of it. Enough of it that gives you a wonderful idea.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote a song called Lorraine about my sister's career. And, you know, I just was full of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so exciting to be writing, finally, with nobody looking over my shoulder and telling me what to rewrite.
Yeah, telling you, that won't work. Take that out.
Right, but you know, you become your own judge and your own critic, and you're much harsher on yourself than anybody could ever be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I really thought that I was doing a good job. You know, I was really happy with what I was writing. And then, you know, and then months would go by and I'd look back on a song I started with and think, ooh, well, that was not that good. But then I ended up eventually, after years of it, with a good catalog and some good CDs that I really am proud of. And my newest one, strangely enough, was some of the rejects from my last CD that I loved, but I didn't want to do a really long CD. So I put together what I hadn't used, and I thought, are these good enough? Were they good enough to be on that CD that I, you know, didn't put them on?
Mm-hmm.
And they were, you know, and then I recorded a few more to add to it. And I still have a whole bunch of stuff I still didn't use. I have a whole new CD could come out like any day, because I didn't put any comedy songs on this particular one. I have most of my CDs have, well, I say most of my CDs. I had two CDs before that. They each had one or two comedy songs on them.
Mm-hmm.
That's a category, you know, they're not novelty songs. They just have a twist to them usually that's amusing. But anyway, I didn't have anything on this particular new one. It really was all about what happens, the beginning, the middle, and the end of a love affair. And, you know, of course, I lived through it. And, you know, I'm just really proud of all those songs. And there's more collaborations on that, too, things people I wrote with along the way, whose writing I admire, you know, and got to write a song with them. Like the title song is written by my friend Richard Goldman, who's just a great songwriter. That's What Love Can Do to Your Heart. I love that song so much.
How do you usually co-write? Do you, like, are you sitting in the same room with them, or do you hand them, like, what you've done and ask them to give you their notes on it?
I've written in so many different ways. I mean, all ways, really. I've given people melodies. I've given people lyrics. I've sat in the same room. I've started something and then found that I really couldn't finish it and given it to somebody else. I've done that for them. You know, I'd say everything, because it's just another way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people who, you know, have a steady gig of writing with one collaborator, and they sit in the same room and, you know, fight and do all that. But I don't really, I did that for 16 to 20 years as a TV writer. I don't really have the desire to do that again. The collaborators I've used, like Rich Goldman and Corey Bishop, I have several songs that I wrote with her on my new CD. They were very difficult for me to work with, not because they're difficult people, but because we're both, you know, all of us have a really strong idea about what way something should go.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say that in the case of those two people, I always deferred to them because I was always so impressed with their writing.
So does melody come the same time as the words, or are you kind of working out of your words?
Some of the stuff I like best that I've written, that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
When I say that I like best, I don't mean that they necessarily are the best words or even the best melody, but that I enjoy singing the most are the ones where there was something in the way the words were put together that suggested a melody. Like, I have some children's CDs. I'm starting a new business of children's CDs, and the opening song on both of the ones that are out now, or one's about to come out, but anyway... are written, the song, the lyrics are written by a guy named Bob McClurg.
Mm-hmm.
He and I put melodies to them, and he writes a lyric in a certain way that suggests, in my mind anyway, a certain kind of melody. And they're so, those songs are so catchy. I can't think of a better word. I mean, they're things that, when you see kids react to those two songs, it's wonderful. Their whole bodies react to it, especially if they've heard it once or twice. Because music's all about familiarity anyway. Mm-hmm. You hear a song once, you may not pay attention to it, and suddenly you hear it on the radio again, and you're just like, whoa, how did I miss that the first time?
Yeah.
That's like so amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, well, that's how these two songs, I think, affect children. Mm-hmm. And it's really sort of the thing that inspired me to go on and do this, because I had no desire to sing to a group of children, really.
Uh-huh.
But if they know the material, they're just like an adult audience.
Yeah.
Even three-year-olds, they, at least for, you know, for 15 or 20 minutes, they are.
Right.
Then after that, you know.
And the shows are much shorter with kids.
Yeah.
With your attention span.
Well, also, you have to do things in your show. It's just me up there singing, and their parents aren't there. If it's in a school classroom, it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's great for 15 minutes, and then somebody in the back moves, and it's like a ping pong ball, you know.
Right, yeah.
It's like they suddenly, they're all moving.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're lucky if you have some movement songs.
Yeah.
But even that, it's hard to control that because they're right. so energetic. And it's great. You know, it's mm-hmm. a great thing.
But you did a children's album with your daughter a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah. That was the first one. And now I'm starting a business with those now. But I released that one in 2014, I think.
Yeah, I think it was 2014.
Yeah, and this new one that's coming out, we just printed, you know, pressed it, and it's coming out. I don't know. Do we have a set release date for Shoebox Town? Liza, do we have a set release date for Shoebox Town? We have a release date in June.
Oh, awesome.
So it'll be launching the whole business and stuff like that.
So where will people be able to find that?
Hopefully it will be such a splash, I would assume on Facebook, of course, but on other, I don't know. You know, I have, these people are working on it, and I don't know what they're doing. But all I know is it should be. And, you know, we have a distributor. I've never had a distributor. You know, distributors were common when record companies were common, you know, mm-hmm. and were in power. But once the music industry started changing, it was hard to get a distributor. I don't know how this happened, but it just happened, and I feel so blessed, so lucky. It didn't happen with my adult stuff, you know, but it is happening with the kids' stuff, and they're now going to take my adult stuff, too. They're going to do that, distribute that. I don't know how this will happen. You know, there's branding. There's all kinds of things now that I don't know how to do, and I'm just praying they know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
The artwork is my daughter's, so I have faith in that. And the music is mine, and I have faith in that. So let's see.
I'm sure it'll be a wonderful
it should be,
project.
It should be terrific. You know, the company's called Run Along Home. It's named after a song that I used to sing to my daughter when she was little.
Oh, nice.
And she did the logo. You know, she did this really cute logo for them, and these two women have taken over the whole thing.
Is that what your daughter does? Is she an illustrator? Or?
She's an artist, and she's also a comedy writer. We did a show called Charlotte's Shorts, which was short vignette little things that she wrote, and we got the Groundlings to do it. Before she just had a baby. So, I mean, that's what she's doing now. Mm-hmm. She's with her baby. But before that, while she was pregnant, and even before that, we were doing shows at the Groundlings called Charlotte Shorts.
Mm-hmm.
And we're using the Groundling people to be in it. And it was so good. So much fun. You can look that up, too, Zillion
okay.
Bell.
Uh-huh.
I've been in some movies with some big stars, like Seth Rogen uses
mm-hmm.
her a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah,
she's from the Groundlings. If you look up Charlotte Shorts, Zillion Bell, she did one that's really funny that Charlotte wrote. I think it's called The Smallest Giraffe. Really funny. And then there's one by this guy, Jordan Black. He did a character she created called Donald Big Below. That's worth looking at. Very funny and offensive. And, you know, she's, and my sister did some of them. And, Charlotte's Shorts. I don't know, you know, when you look it up, I think there's another thing called Charlotte's Shorts, unfortunately. Anyway, if you keep looking and you find, you know, people like Jordan Black and Jillian Bell and Lorraine Newman doing Charlotte's Shorts, you'll find them eventually.
Okay. Awesome. So on the album, That's What Love Can Do to Your Heart, you have a band that's been playing with you for, all your three CDs now, the Replacements.
Well, they started with me for, 2005 or so. I just disbanded them about a year ago because I found that I wasn't writing new stuff. I was, there were some personal things going on, physical things, and then also my daughter was pregnant, and I thought, I'm just going to take a break. Mm-hmm. So I'm out performing by myself now and just starting to get back into it in small clubs here. And I still have lunch with my band, but I'm not using them right now. And I miss it in a way, but in a way I don't. I don't miss being the boss.
Yeah. I think it's kind of freeing to not have a band to worry about. In some ways, it's kind of freeing.
It's freeing, but then, I'm limited on stage as to what I feel like singing without backup singers. Mm-hmm. I write really harmonic things. I miss, like my song on my first CD called Night Blooming Jasmine. Mm-hmm. I love that song so much. I can't do it because in my mind, I'm hearing those harmonies, and it's just not the same, When I'm by myself, I have to sing the songs where the words are the main focus. At least that's how I feel. I mean, that may not be true, really, mm-hmm. but it feels that way. Like, yeah. I have to sing Fire Up the Weed because it's funny, or mm-hmm. I Just See You because it makes people cry. Those things where the words are the outstanding part mm-hmm. of it.
I want to ask you about a couple of the songs on the album.
Okay.
One of my favorite songs on there is Flowers and Words of Love. What was
that? Oh, God, I love that. You love that. Oh, I love it.
What was the inspiration for that song?
It was the show The Office.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was a TV show, The Office. It was like, because there's all these nerdy guys and these girls getting crushes on these nerdy guys. And also, you see how non-PC that song is now. That second mm-hmm. verse is, that I'm wishing that he would follow me into the coffee room and push me up against the wall. Then all of a sudden the Me Too stuff started. I thought, oh, that's not too cool. But, that's what you want. Like those kinds of guys who aren't going to ever make the first move.
Right.
They're not going to ask you out. They're not going to. So, your fantasy is that they're going to suddenly take control.
Right.
So that's really what that was about. And it was, I had a boyfriend at the time that I wrote it who was like, not a nerdy guy, but the kind of guy that would take control. Like, you could see him pushing you up against the wall. He didn't do that, mm-hmm. but he had that personality. Mm-hmm. And with his sleeves rolled up because his arms were good looking. It's like, it's so funny that I went through this period of, like, loving the way his arms looked. and I thought, this is crazy. I had to put it in a song.
Yeah. I guess the reason I like that song is because my husband's sort of that nerdy guy that doesn't make the first move. I had to propose to him, so.
Well, good for you. I'm glad you did it.
Yeah.
I'm glad you did it. It's that thing of, also, it's that double-edged thing of, like, you have a crush on the nerdiest guy in the room and you don't want anyone to see you with him.
Yeah.
realize uh-huh. I have a crush. I don't want anyone to know about this.
Right.
And
right.
then of course you the more the time goes by, you do. You want everybody to know. And you don't want him to know that you're interested and all the stuff that the intrigue that goes on in a relationship. And so it's at the beginning of that album it's like the second song because it's mm-hmm. It's the happy stuff about love. It's the fun stuff. It's, and I also wrote that tune to be reminiscent of stuff I listened to in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
in my mind. I don't know if it strikes anybody else that way, but anyway, the hook on that song is to me, it's a very 50s.
Yeah, I can hear that for sure, yeah. Another song is Alone. Is that one about someone in particular?
It's after I broke up with the guy that I wrote that other song, Flowers and Words of Love, Love About. I actually was in a songwriting group at the time. There were some great songwriters in that group. And there was the guy that put that together has passed away. He had pancreatic cancer and none of us knew it. And he would, it was like one of the joys of his life was to come and run this group and give us suggestions to write. He'd give us a prompt, and we would all go away, and then next week we would come back, and everybody there will have written about the same thing, the same
mm-hmm.
subject.
Mm-hmm.
And so the subject for the song Alone was, he said, I want you to write a song that is the perception of alone. He didn't say being alone, or he just said the perception of alone, which is a weird way to put that. And I don't know, that's what came out of me, and I'm very literal, so I called the song Alone. Mm-hmm. And just made a story that fit, was kind of what I was going through, or I had, actually it was something I had gone through before too, when I was younger, which was to be in love with somebody and then break up and have them leave town and then not know that they had come back to town and have other people telling you, oh, you know, I saw so-and-so. And just was devastating. And so I tried to get that feeling in there, and how you plan your whole life around somebody sometimes,
mm-hmm.
and how devastated you are when it's over.
Right. Yeah.
And you get dumped. You know, it's like getting dumped too.
Yeah, that's true with friendships too, or even with
yep.
our family. Or you know, mm-hmm. you have a falling out with yeah. a family member. So
it totally is, and that song. I don't know, you know, I have to know where songs come from, because it, the music in that song, the melody, which I love, you know, I think the song that was happening at the time was Crazy.
Yeah, I know you're talking
about. You think I'm crazy,
right.
You're crazy, that song.
Mm-hmm.
That song was, I think, was popular, and it has changes in it that, you know, the kind of changes that are in Alone are kind of like those kinds of changes. That's sort of all I can say about the music and that. And the music is what makes that song for me.
Yeah.
The chorus melody.
I love the sound of the song, So Many Letters, too. I just like it's got this...
Oh, I do, too. I love that, too. And that's what I sound like. I wrote that song. That was one of the first songs I ever wrote. Like, when I was a teenager. I actually
really?
Wrote that song. Yeah, it was kind of imitating Bob Dylan.
That's awesome. You went back that far and grab a song from that far back. That's great.
But then I did the CD in Nashville, and the guys, when I brought them that song, that's what they did with it. That's all them, the style of it and everything. You know, I mean, I guess it was inherent in the song, but, you know, they made that song so much better.
It's got a great sound to it. It's very well produced, and I like the
great.
Sound of your voice on that one, too. It's really good.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Do you have a favorite song that you've written?
Wow, nothing jumped to my mind. My favorite song is usually the newest.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a grandson now. I'm a grandmother. And
congratulations.
Yes, thank you so much. And I just wrote a song called My Baby's Baby, and you can find that on YouTube. Just type in Tracy Newman, My Baby's Baby, and try to watch it from beginning to end, because there's some funny stuff at the end. I love that song right now. But, you know, let's see, if I had to say, well, you know, probably the song I like performing the most is Fire Up the Weed. I really love to perform that, and that was on my second album, and I like performing the title song from that, too, I Just See You,
uh-huh.
because I like it when men cry in the audience. And sometimes it makes it the women cry, of course, but the men, too. And, of course, before Merle Haggard died, I loved performing Table 9.
Yeah.
Which was about Haggard. I haven't performed it since he died. I don't know if it would work as well, or if I will feel it the way that I felt it when he was alive.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I would. I don't know. As far as my favorite songs, I think that I've kind of answered that. That's based on what I like to perform. Also, some of my kids' songs are my favorite songs, too. But again, it's the newer stuff. I like the new stuff.
So you mentioned you have the children's thing you're doing, and that's coming out in June. Is there anything else
mm-hmm.
that you have coming up that you want to mention?
Well, you know, the new CD is coming out in June, but anybody can find my current CD that's out, even though we're going to repackage things. But that one's called I Can Swing Forever, and that's on, I think you can see things, mostly you can see things on my website.
Mm-hmm.
It'll lead you to places to buy things. But what else is coming up? Well, I'm going to be at the Coffee Gallery, which is in Pasadena, with Art Padel.
Awesome.
And a guy named Dolan Ellis, who I was in the Christie's with. And that's going to be very exciting to be reunited with one of my old Christie friends.
Yeah.
And that's in June. And we just bought a house. I helped my daughter and her husband. They wanted to buy a house here, and they have a house in Seattle, so we looked around here, and I helped them find something, and that's going to take up the next couple of months, because
mm-hmm.
they're going to move. And I'm just playing with my grandson.
Being a grandma.
Being a grandma.
Probably the best job ever.
Well,
right?
You know, it's really something, you know. I didn't really expect to feel this way exactly. Or I didn't know I would, put it that way. I knew I'd love him. You know, you love mm-hmm. your kids and your grandson. And I was, of course, crazy about my daughter. I didn't think I'd ever feel that again. But here I am.
Wonderful.
Yeah, he's quite a kid.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with me. The new album is called That's What Love Can Do Your Heart, and you can find it mm-hmm. on CD Baby, Amazon, Bandcamp, iTunes, and your website is tracynewman.com, and it's got a lot of great mm-hmm. information there and a lot of great ways to listen to your music. And then, of course, always go to YouTube and check out the Tracy Newman page there as well.
Don't forget to look up Tracy Newman doing Cripple Creek with the banjo. That's really fun.
Yeah, and that was from the What's New program you did back in the 60s, right?
1965, yeah.
Awesome.
And also, don't forget to look up My Baby's Baby.
Okay, great. All right.
That on YouTube. Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Tracy, for talking to me.
Thank you, Kathy. This has been a pleasure.